Hello, welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, one of the hosts of the channel. Today I'll be speaking with Anna Andreeva about her recent book, Assembling Shinto, Buddhist Approaches to Kami Worship in Medieval Japan, published by Harvard University Asia Center in 2017. In this work, Andreeva focuses on a complex network of religious sites, figures, and texts to help us better understand the way in which Japanese deities were worshipped in medieval Japan. In so doing, she illuminates the medieval stages of a process that led to what was later called Shinto, and adds to the growing body of scholarship that challenges the relatively recent idea that Shinto is simply the native religion of Japan, unchanged since ancient times. To tackle such a grand undertaking, Andreeva focuses on a mountain in central Japan called Mount Miwa, as well as on Ise, the location of the Ise shrines and the abode of the most important imperial deity. Beginning with the significance of Mount Miwa as a religious site for pre-9th century Japanese rulers, Andreeva charts the decline of this mountain's importance during the 8th to 12th centuries and the subsequent revival of the site during the 13th century by non-elite practitioners of esoteric Buddhism stationed at small Miwa temples and by the Saidaiji lineage under the direction of the Buddhist monk Eison and his disciples. Continuing chronologically, she then shows how the 13th century revival led sometime later to the emergence of the so-called Miwa-ryu Shinto, an eclectic tradition which spread to different regions of Japan and whose influence continued until the early 13th century. Central to Andreeva's project is the world of Japanese esoteric Buddhist thought and ritual, for it was in this setting that the Japanese deities could be transformed from beings characterized by ignorance and desire into embodiments of Buddhist awakening. Throughout the book, Andreeva addresses many religious elements, Japanese and not, that were incorporated into esoteric Buddhist traditions active at Mount Miwa and Ise. These include the incorporation of deities from ancient Japanese mythology into medieval legends and esoteric ritual, serpentine and dragon imagery, initiation rites modeled on the enthronement of a king, pilgrimage, and the use of royal symbolism. In addition, she provides a number of detailed descriptions of rituals and translations of liturgical and exegetical works. The book's topic is very complex. Andreeva has opted out of the usual approach, which would be to trace the development of a single figure, text, idea, or institution. This makes the project far more difficult for the researcher, but has the invaluable advantage that it allows the reader to perceive and appreciate the fascinating networks that show how medieval Japanese religion actually existed and developed on the ground. Beyond its importance for understanding Japanese Buddhist intellectual history, esoteric Buddhist thought and ritual, and the development of Shinto, the book also serves as an example of how to study the intricate social, economic, and geographical networks that lie behind the development of religious ideas, practices, and institutions. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. Today I'm with Anna Andreeva, who is a research fellow at the University of Heidelberg, where she conducts research on Japanese religion with a particular focus on medieval Japanese esoteric Buddhism and on Buddhist medical theories. Welcome, Anna, and thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Luke. I'm really very pleased to be invited, and I'm looking forward to our interview.
I want to begin, as I always do, by asking how you came to the study of religion, of Buddhism, and of Japan.
Perhaps I could start from the Japan part. I was actually a teenager when I came across Russian translations of Japanese poetry. And that piqued my interest so much that I began to study Japanese when I was 14 years old. First at the sort of evening courses and then by myself with a private teacher. And after that, I decided to become a translator and interpreter of Japanese, Russian, and English. But after my years at the university, when I was an undergraduate in Siberia, I understood that Japanese literature was extremely very interesting, including poetry. And I became very interested in classical Japanese poetry. And so all the roads lead to Saigyo, the Buddhist priest and a poet of early medieval Japan. And that's how I started. I started with studying the poetry of Saigyo, in Japan at the Kanazawa University, where I was doing my master's degree in Japanese classical literature. And of course, you can't really study and understand Saigyo's poetry without understanding of religion. So I think, long story short, in the figure of Saigyo, there were all these big three topics, religion, Buddhism, and Japan, that came together. And that's how I started.
How did you come then to focus specifically on the topic of this book, namely the sacred site of Mount Miwa, though you focus on quite a few other sites as well, and on so on the sacred site of Miwa and on medieval approaches to worshiping these deities we called kami?
When I was thinking of the possible topic for my PhD dissertation at Cambridge in back in 2002, one of the senior colleagues in the field, Mark Tewin, suggested that I look at Mount Miwa because it was extremely interesting. When I actually wanted to learn more about esoteric Buddhism in medieval Japan, again, being inspired by the figure of Saigyo, who talks about contemplation on the moon, who uses a lot of allusions to the Tendai and Shingon teachings in his poetry. And so this is how I came across Mount Miwa. With a good advice from a senior colleague, but also because Mount Miwa, of course, figured very prominently in the early history of Japan. So it was a very famous site that loomed very large in Japanese pre-modern history.
So the fact that Shinto is not some pre-Buddhist nature religion is going to be obvious for listeners who study Japan, but nevertheless, I want to, before we get into the content of the actual book, I would like to ask you to disabuse us of this idea that Shinto is the native Japanese religion, as opposed to Buddhism, which is the foreign Buddhism. But more importantly, to explain where this book fits in the very active endeavor of scholars to better understand the history of Japanese religion.
Well, the book focuses on Mount Miwa, but in fact, it's probably just one example in a long line of the books that focus on sacred sites in pre-modern Japan, especially medieval Japan. So from that viewpoint, the methodology that was started by Alain Grappard with his monograph on the Buddhist temple Kofukuji and the Kasuga Shrine was a very early example and the kind of inspiration for this book as well. But the main approach to this kind of study of sacred sites in Japanese history is perhaps to have a glance in the long durée of how the local cults and the local worships, the local kinds of religiosity change with the arrival of new ideas. And in that sense, of course, we cannot, when looking at the history of Mount Miwa in early Japan, in the sort of the times when the earliest Japanese records were written down in the 8th century, we cannot really talk about Shinto as such. That along many things have been said about what we can and cannot understand under this fairly modern term, Shinto. So I prefer to use the term kami worship. And in that sense, Mount Miwa is a center for veneration of kami for a very, very long time. We see in the 8th century Japanese records that Mount Miwa is a kind of a it's an abode for the deities that are local, but also the deities of continental origins that come together with the successive waves of immigration from the Korean peninsula and so on. And this at the same time, we also see the approaches of early approaches of the Buddhist actors, of the Buddhist monks, who also come to Miwa to do something, to proselytize the newly arriving doctrines of Buddhism, to practice medicine, and so on. So in a way, the site acts as a kind of an anchor, which helps us to look at all the successive waves of appropriation of new ideas, including the Buddhist ideas.
As we've already mentioned, the book focuses in part on the site of Mount Miwa, which is located along the southeastern rim of the Yamato Basin in central Japan. So this is about 55 kilometers south of Kyoto. Now, and I should mention for listeners, you have some very useful maps in the beginning of the book that make it very easy to sort of understand the location of Mount Miwa in relation to other sacred sites in the area. Now, in the first chapter, you provide a very detailed early history of Mount Miwa, as well as its deities, shrines, and temples. This chapter is going to be required reading for anyone wanting to understand the origins of the sacred site, and it's very fascinating. Now, there's far, far too much detail to cover in the interview, but I was wondering if you could just give us a brief idea of why and in what way Mount Miwa was an important religious site early on.
Mount Miwa was probably one of the earliest sites and sacred mountains to be associated with the early rulers of Japan, the early Yamato rulers. If we can rely on the notoriously difficult to read early records of Nihon Shoki that were commissioned by the imperial house in the 8th century, we can notice right away that Mount Miwa was an important important place for these early rulers. Right there, they venerated the deities enshrined on the mountains, some of these deities were considered to be local, and some were transported or arrived from the coastal areas of Japan, namely the area called Izumo that was facing Korea. So on the one hand, even in this early period, we can already discern quite a complicated transcultural element in the history of Mount Miwa's deities and the sacred site itself. In principle, there wasn't actually really that much on the mountain. Perhaps the three rocks called Iwakura that were positioned on a different places on the slope of the mountain. Perhaps this was the earliest sites of the veneration of this threatening and very dangerous, but also at times benevolent and protective deities that to which early Japan rulers felt an affinity to. So in that sense, between this, and of course there is also an archaeological material that suggests that Mount Miwa had several ritual sites that were associated with trans-regional trade, perhaps trans-regional exchange, and of course it was located very close to the various mounds of the early Japanese rulers. So there is a lot of archaeological materials that suggest that this was a very special place.
So the picture you paint is of this site of Mount Miwa that's very important, particularly for rulers early on. But then in the second chapter, you note that, you mentioned this in the first chapter too, but you note that during the Heian period, being the late 8th to the late 12th century, Miwa's significance for the political elite declined. And with this, references to Mount Miwa and its deity and official records largely disappear. In the second chapter, you introduce us to some developments during the Heian period that set the stage for Miwa's later history. And more specifically, you note that the Nara Temple Kofukuji became increasingly economically and politically dominant in the area, and that much of Miwa's lands and tax revenue were essentially taken by Kofukuji. But at the same time, Miwa becomes part of this these important pilgrimage routes that link Kyoto to Nara, and then Nara to a number of flourishing Buddhist sites to the south of Miwa and to the east of Miwa. So how do these pilgrimage routes develop, and how are they important for Miwa's later history?
I think this chapter is precisely where this hidden and forgotten history of Mount Miwa and its people, its practitioners, really begins. Because on the one hand, any written texts that were produced at Miwa itself, they kind of disappear. During the Heian period, we see the reflections of the sacred sites and its practitioners through some other glasses. Mainly, you mentioned Kofukuji, and this becomes a very, very big presence in the Yamato region in central Japan. So Mount Miwa disappears a little bit, but this is where I think the actual story of medieval kami worship in this region begins. Because it is precisely through this network of pilgrimage routes that connect the nearby sacred mountains, which house the quarters or the small mountain temples where mountain ascetics could congregate and practice the seasonal rites. So we gradually see, once we divert our gaze from the big temples, we begin to see that there there seems to be quite a lot of movement, particularly towards the end of the 12th century, around these nearby mountains. And Mount Miwa is included in these pilgrimage routes that extend from the northern part of the Yamato Plain to the south, to the east, to the west. The mountain itself is actually not participating very actively. It is not; it does not attract that many people. They're all on their way somewhere else. They're going to Tonomine, they're going to Kimpusen, to Kumano, and other very renowned sacred sites.
In Chapter 3, you turn to a training hall that appeared at Miwa around the late 12th century and eventually took on the temple name Byodoji. Now, by 1235, this training hall had developed into a small temple complex consisting of a few buildings and a library, and a number of monks from the area came there to stay or to use materials in the library. What was the relationship with the wider Buddhist network at this point in its history? Miwa's relationship with the wider Buddhist network at this point in history during the first third or first half of the 13th century?
That's a very interesting and complicated question, because this particular chapter then begins to build on chapter 2, in which I discuss this network of pilgrimage routes nearby in the Yamato region. But in this chapter, my main interest was to cast light on the activities and aspirations of the local non-elite Buddhist practitioners who were stationed near Mount Miwa, and Byodoji was definitely one of the places that housed such practitioners. Some of them were able to travel and be accepted at the more established, very renowned centers of esoteric Buddhist scholarship, such as, for example, Daigoji or Koya-san, quite some distance away. And these practitioners, despite their lack of extremely high social status, they were able nevertheless to learn very directly the complicated doctrines and rituals of esoteric Buddhism from renowned masters who were stationed at this particular esoteric Buddhist temples, namely Daigoji and Koya-san. So that's just one example of what kind of activities they were involved in. And secondly, of course, Mount Miwa being on the crossroads of these intersecting mountain pilgrimage routes, of course, the practitioners at from Mount Miwa were able to travel to other smaller mountain temples and sites. And in this way, they traversed this terrain of the Yamato region very, very actively. So one can imagine that they were personally involved in a number of different kinds of practices that existed at different places around the Yamato region.
So moving on in rather rapid fashion, in Chapter 4, you turn to the development of a relationship between the temple Saidaiji and Mount Miwa. Now, Saidaiji is a large and historically important temple in Nara that had declined after being partly destroyed by fires in the 9th and 10th centuries, but which had been revived in the 13th century by the monk Aizon, who was a Shingon or esoteric Buddhist monk and is well known for his interest in and study of the Vinaya, the Buddhist monastic precepts. So here in this chapter, you describe in great detail both the chronology and nature of the relationship between Saidaiji and Miwa. And I'd like to ask why Aizon was interested in Miwa in the first place, because as you know, by this point, it had shifted from its very early importance for Japanese rulers to something of a localized site that didn't have much importance beyond its immediate environment. So why was Aizon interested in Miwa in the first place? Why did he make his first trip there in 1241? And why did he continue to make trips to the mountain throughout his life during the 13th century?
I think it was always going to be quite a tall order to explain what Aizon thought of Miwa or what he didn't think of Miwa. For me, it remains a kind of a mystery, because Aizon, of course, is a very looming, also very large in the history of medieval Japanese Buddhism, and many fine scholars already produced a lot of interesting research involving this figure, focusing on this figure. But for me, part of this mystery can perhaps be solved by considering the fact that Eizon was born in the Yamato region. He was born in the village of Wani, which was actually located not too far from within the respective region of the Yamato plain. So it is possible that he was informed, he knew the stories and the legendary lore about the deities of Mount Miwa and so on. So in that sense, it's not really surprising that that he eventually started to visit Mount Miwa. But what I found surprising in the course of my research was to what extent this Eizon and Saidaiji lineage then incorporated Mount Miwa and its religious facilities. By then, there was also a shrine lineage, the priestly lineage of shrine priests who was also living and looking after the sacred sites on Mount Miwa. So to what extent the Saidaiji lineage incorporated Mount Miwa into its own network, that's what I found really surprising and interesting to focus on. And just in we spoke in the second chapter, we spoke about the approaches of Kōfukuji, the sort of economic and administrative approaches, encroachments of Kōfukuji on Mount Miwa and its land estates. Saidaiji's approach was not like that, but at the same time, it seems that the Saidaiji lineage was very interested in reviving this old, forgotten sacred site that didn't formally belong to any powerful patrons. So I think for Saidaiji, there was a lot of enthusiasm for the places like Mount Miwa and many others. We know that they restored quite a few old shrines and temples in the course of their careers. And Eizon, of course, played a very crucial role in this particular process. But what happened also is that because the Saidaiji lineage has recorded one of the key medieval texts about Mount Miwa, Miwa Daimyojin Engi, they kind of wrote out the historical contributions and intellectual contributions of other practitioners who were stationed at Byodoji and Miwa Bessho. So in a sense, this chapter is a kind of a struggle to, again, to rescue these invisible non-elite practitioners that historically made Mount Miwa their home from the more literate, more socially tuned-in monks of the Saidaiji lineage.
In Chapter 5, and there's a lot more in Chapter 4 we didn't talk about, but I want to move on to Chapter 5, in which you focus quite a bit on the site of Ise, which many listeners will know is important for the worship of Amaterasu, the sort of sun deity, imperial deity. And indeed, Ise is of great importance to your study. So why the centrality of Ise in your study? What's the importance of the relationship between Ise and Miwa? And what does looking at Ise tell us about the way in which Buddhists thought about and worshipped kami in the 13th and 14th centuries?
One of the key texts which I mentioned that was produced in the early 14th century by the Saidaiji lineage, or rather recorded with the help of the Saidaiji lineage, is Miwa Daimyojin Engi. And this text gives us a very new sort of revolutionary outlook on this ancient cultic site, Mount Miwa. And the text does so precisely by highlighting the connections to the Ise shrines, which were the central sacred site for the worship of Amaterasu, the imperial deity, just as you said. And so we discover that in medieval Japan, Mount Miwa, having returned to the scene of having recovered its religious identity, or rather having created a new religious identity with the appropriation of many esoteric Buddhist elements, Mount Miwa emerges in the 14th century as a kind of a counterpoint to the Ise shrines, which technically do not allow the Buddhist language, do not allow the Buddhist monks or the Buddhist elements to exist on the premises of the Issei shrines. On the one hand, of course, there's a lot has been said about the ambiguity of the taboo on Buddhist anything at Issei. But through this text, Miwa Daimyojin Engi, Mount Miwa begins to promote itself as a sacred site that is, first of all, is older than the Issei shrines. There is a very ancient history of Mount Miwa, which we talked about at the very beginning. And the Saidaiji monks they record the legendary lore about Mount Miwa in such a way that helps to construct this sacred site as a site of enshrinement of a very powerful deity that is much older than Amaterasu. And at the same time, that provides the links to the imperial deity and many other sacred sites, including the Tendai temples and so on. So through this text, we see Mount Miwa created as a new powerful powerful sacred site that wants to stand on its own and yet to exhibit its own connections, historical links to other important sacred sites such as Issei.
So essentially what we have, and this is a gross oversimplification, though, is a sort of a process by which Mount Miwa is originally this very important site for Yamato rulers, for Japan's early rulers, and then it sort of declines to the point where it becomes really just a localized religious site, if you will. And then with the involvement of the Saidaiji, of the Saidaiji monks, it gets pulled into this larger network and becomes this very important center for Buddhist worship and kami worship. So moving on to chapter six, you begin to by discussing the way in which, at least in Shingon, the kami or deities were, and here I quote you, indispensable to the practice of esoteric Buddhism. They could act as crucial mediators, activating the prized state of enlightenment. And here you also address the way in which kami, particularly when portrayed as snakes or serpents, were seen as both a symbol of greed, aversion, and ignorance, the Buddhism's so-called three poisons, and as those figures who could overcome these poisons. So how did kami function soteriologically in the type of Buddhism we see at Miwa during this period? And how do they have this sort of ambiguous dual role?
What you just have described, namely the theories about the three poisons and the kami that could be perceived as snakes or serpents, this kind of arguments were, it seems that this kind of arguments were already quite widely known across Japan. And the discussions of the three poisons and serpent deities, of course, we can see very widely in pre-modern East Asian materials, in Chinese Buddhist writings and so on. So it's not only Japan that knows about this kind of things. But what happens at Miwa and why Miwa suddenly emerges as a powerful site of the kami worship in medieval Japan is that one of the most well-known legends about Mount Miwa and its deity was already recorded in the 8th century, and the Saidaiji lineage certainly incorporated and reinforced this legend within the early 14th century Miwa Daimyojin Engi. To the Buddhist eye, to the eyes of medieval Buddhists in Japan, Mount Miwa was, of course, a site of enshrinement of the most important, most powerful serpent deity, or Mononushi. So it was very famous for this particular legend that Mount Miwa was a house or an abode of a serpent deity, also the plague deity too. So it was on the one hand very fearsome, but at the same time it was well incorporated. It was a place which propagated Buddhism since ancient times, according to its own tradition, right? So in that sense, the local practitioners and certainly the Saidaiji lineage were interested in Mount Miwa and its deity as a kind of a sort of a channel that could connect the local context, the local sacred landscape, to the distant divinities of esoteric Buddhism, for example. And so during this time, Mount Miwa becomes a site which is also sort of swept through which these esoteric theories about kami being the serpents and being the channels to the esoteric deities, being manifestations of esoteric deities, it kind of sweeps Mount Miwa too. And we see reflection of this process in the Miwa Daimyojin Engi. But with time, it seems that the ritual aspect of these ideas, the fact that the kami could be ritually incorporated into the new salvatory techniques of achieving esoteric Buddhist enlightenment. That particular event also happens at Miwa during the late 13th century. So by the 14th century, Miwa, again, by the means of the Saidaiji lineage that connects it so well to the network, esoteric network at Ise, Mount Miwa is also included into the practices in which kami are invoked as a part of esoteric ritual.
So one of the things you do in this chapter, and well, and indeed elsewhere in the book, is you give us these really fantastic descriptions of rituals. And again, these are far too detailed to cover in the course of the interview. But I was wondering if you could just pick a ritual from medieval Mount Miwa that, or from the Miwa tradition that you feel is representative and give us an idea of what sort of ritual it is.
In many ways, Mount Miwa has become famous yet again in the 17th century when we come across a lot of copied documents, ritual documents that mention a ritual called Miwaryu Jingi Kanjo, the Abiseka initiation into the kami secret in the Miwa style. And in my quest to debunk what it means, I realized that, again, it's this those non-elite invisible practitioners of esoteric Buddhism that were so that inhabited Mount Miwa and Byodoji Temple in the 13th and 14th century that played a great role together with the Saidaiji lineage that was far more visible, that is far more visible in the historical sources. And these groups played a great role in constructing the ritual traditions of Mount Miwa during that time. And so one of the most prominent features of these very rich activities, ritual activities, was a Jingi Kanjo, the Abiseka in the initiation into the kami secrets, which involved venerating the local deities as a part of esoteric ritual. So one of the very prominent and interesting things in which the practitioners from Miwa played role was the construction and spread of a certain simplified ritual, which was called Denbo Aizen, that was focusing on a serpent imagery that on the one hand could be interpreted as a manifestation of esoteric deity Aizen Myo, but on the other hand that could represent at the same time either Amaterasu, the imperial deity in its serpent form, that could on the one hand was a manifestation of the three poisons, but on the other hand, had a power to pacify and these three poisons and convert them into the sort of this divine energy that could lead a practitioner to esoteric enlightenment. So Denbo Aizen was a ritual that involved a simplified imagery of serpentine deities, of serpentine kami, but at the same time, it connected the practitioners to the very complex divine states that were explained by the doctrines and scriptures of esoteric Buddhism, such as, for example, the Yugikyo Sutra, the Yogin Sutra. So in that sense, during the medieval period, Mount Miwa was at the very thick of it, practicing these rituals that looked fairly simple on the surface, but contained a lot of things to unpack to the initiated practitioner. And from this viewpoint, Mount Miwa continued to produce these and similar esoteric rituals that involved kami, and up to a point when it really became famous as a bearer of this Miwaryu Shinto, a phenomenon that emerged during the early modern period, which imagined the Miwa practitioners as the bearers of some kind of special Shinto, some kind of special form of kami worship.
Now, in chapter 7, you move forward in time and look at Miwaru Shinto as it developed from the mid-medieval period through the Edo period, so from about the 13th to the early 19th century. Now, there are many developments that you address, but I just wanted to ask you about the importance of the imperial regalia that we find in many Miwaru ritual manuals. What are the imperial regalia and what's their importance for the Miwa tradition?
The imagery of the three imperial regalia is encountered not only in the Miwaru ritual documents. Of course, there are other traditions which also incorporate this imagery and this particular three objects, the mirror, the sword, and the jewel. What is interesting in the Miwa's case, in the case of 17th century Miwaru ritual documents, is that these documents paint a special picture. They suggest that these non-elite practitioners of esoteric Buddhism who would be initiated in the Miwaru tradition would use these ritual props or this ritual imagery to acquire a way to become a symbolic emperor, a symbolic ruler of Japan, to step into the shoes of an early Yamato ruler who submits to Amaterasu to become even Amaterasu, the imperial deity itself. So in this sense, the imagery of the imperial regalia is, on the one hand, it's a kind of a standard ritual element, but on the other hand, it's a very powerful tool for a practitioner of esoteric forms of kami worship to become to reach a higher state of existence, to become a symbolic ruler, to become a Buddha, to become a divinity and the kami themselves.
We've taken a lot of your time, and I should emphasize to listeners that we've really only covered a little bit. It's a really fascinating topic, incredibly complex. I seriously admire you for taking on such a complicated period and such a complicated topic. As a final question, I wanted to ask what you're working on currently now that this project is finished.
When I was working on my PhD dissertation, focusing first on Mount Miwa and then consequently expanding into this realm, into the minds, hopes, and aspirations of the local Buddhist practitioners stationed there, I realized that I spent so much time looking into the minds of men. Right now, I'm very eager to look into the minds and the worlds of women. At the moment, I'm very much interested in a slightly different topic, which still focuses on esoteric Buddhist contributions to the intellectual history of Japan, but from a viewpoint of a very interesting topic, childbirth and women's health. Very recently, I have, at the moment I'm working on a transcription of a two-volume text, a manuscript that I was rediscovered recently at the Kanazawa Bunko Temple Archive in Yokohama in eastern Japan. That is called the Encyclopedia of Childbirth, Sansho Ruijusho in Japanese. And it's a very interesting compilation that casts light not only on the history of medicine as it was understood in medieval Japan, but also I very much hope that it will give us a new information on how the lives of women, everyday lives of women, were framed by the Buddhist knowledge of the workings, internal workings of the women's bodies. So at the moment, I'm very much trying to untangle yet another complex network of texts, actors, Buddhist minds, women's lives, and other people in medieval Japan.
Wow, that sounds great. And we'll look forward to your next book then in a few months' time, hopefully, but maybe longer. I'd like to thank you again for taking the time to speak with me today. That's it for today's New Books in Buddhist Studies, and thank you for all the listeners. See you next time.